Welcome to a podcast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service, or ERS. This podcast highlights an article from Amber Waves, the magazine of the Economic Research Service. We are joined now by Sheila Sankaran, the executive editor of Amber Waves.
Thank you. Here with me today is Lisa Mancino, the author of the Amber Waves article, Insidious Consumption, Surprising Factors That Influence What We Eat and How Much. Lisa, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, Sheila. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with your title. What do you mean exactly by insidious consumption?
Well, the idea of insidious consumption is that unexpected cues can lure us into making choices that, left unchecked, may gradually add up over time and harm our health. The increasing rates of obesity in this country is a pretty noticeable problem of overconsumption. But ironically, the many little things that have helped us get to this place are sometimes very subtle. As economists, we typically focus on how factors like prices and income influence our food choices. But certain behavioral cues can also influence what and how much we eat. Understanding how they work can help us think of new strategies to help people make healthier choices.
What do you mean by behavioral cues?
Every day we have to make, hundreds of decisions. What to eat and how much are just a few. Rather than weigh the pros and cons of each and every possible option, we use a lot of simple decision rules. For example, most of us do not painstakingly weigh our food or count calories to determine how much to eat. Instead, we use some standard simple cues like, I'll eat one sandwich, I'll have a bowl of soup, or I'll stop eating these chips when the bag is empty. On the one hand, this is great. It protects us from information overload and allows us to make quick, reasonably good decisions. On the other hand, these simple decision rules can, from time to time, lead to poor choices. For example, if we are using large bowls or eating from giant bags, we're likely to eat too much. If this was something that happened infrequently, it might not make a difference. But over and over, these small, barely perceptible misjudgments can add up, literally in the form of extra pounds.
So what are some of the standard economic tools, and why do you think it's important to look beyond them?
That's a really good question. Well, one of the most common economic tools used to influence choice is nutrition information, such as dietary guidelines, the food pyramid, and nutrition labels, not to mention the tons of diet books, magazines, newspaper articles, TV shows, and the like. Basically, it is hard to argue that we lack information about what constitutes a healthful diet or why we should choose to have one. But we're still eating too much, and we're still seeing increasing rates of obesity. Some in the public health community are suggesting more direct economic levers to influence food choices. One example is taxing certain foods like salty snacks or sodas. But this idea has some pretty serious shortcomings. For one, it is unclear which foods would be best to tax or how high the tax would need to be to change people's behavior. People's food choices are pretty resistant to changes in price since food is pretty cheap compared to the other things we spend money on. So the tax would have to be pretty hefty to induce change. And this would disproportionately affect lower-income shoppers, since they spend a larger portion of their budget on food. Behavioral economics, on the other hand, uses findings from psychology research to better explain consumer behavior. A benefit of using these findings is that it broadens the possible strategies that can be considered for guiding food choices. For example, research shows that subtle incentives such as product placement, package size, and fixed-cost pricing, all-you-can-eat buffets, encourage us to eat more. These same cues can be effective in encouraging us to eat less and choose healthier foods. And another benefit of using behavioral concepts is that they can be targeted to only those individuals who want help in making better food choices.
So what insights can we get from behavioral economics in explaining how consumers make food choices?
Well, for one thing, research from food psychology suggests that the decisions of what to eat and how much are two very different processes. For example, at the grocery store, I may think about the fact that I am watching my weight and decide to buy baked, low-fat cheese doodles over the regular cheese doodles. But once I open the bag and start eating them, it becomes a fairly mindless activity, even more so if I am also checking emails, watching TV, or chatting on the phone. And as I mentioned earlier, we often use rules of thumb, such as eating one package or one bowlful, to decide how much to eat. Not surprisingly, research finds that larger packages lead to greater consumption. Doubling the portion size can increase consumption up to 45% for some snack foods. And when eating from larger packages, people underestimate how much they eat, more so than when they eat from smaller packages. So package size can really make a difference. We also tend to eat more when we have a greater variety of foods to choose from. For example, people ate 43% more M&Ms when eating from a bowl of 10 colors versus a bowl with 7 colors, even though they all taste the same. And finally, we eat more food when it is more convenient. One experiment found that, in a cafeteria, people ate more ice cream when the cooler door was left open than when it was shut. So, making food slightly less convenient can also help reduce consumption. And the great thing about using these findings from food psychology is that many of the cues that affect eating behaviors can be easily changed, such as closing the cooler door or using smaller packaging.
Lisa, these cues are fun to think about, but how can we apply them to our daily lives?
Well, okay, here's one idea. Default options are a cue. As I mentioned, we make tons of decisions every day. So to make things easier, we typically accept the default option. So when you order a meal at a fast food restaurant, you automatically get French fries as a side, and you usually eat them too. Those French fries are the default option. Just making that default option more healthful by automatically including fresh fruit or a side salad instead could help us make healthier choices. Using commitment devices, such as prepaid cards, is another option that can help us improve choices. We tend to make better food choices when we commit to them ahead of time, rather than making them on the spot. If you're dieting and pack a healthy lunch the night before, you're more likely to stick to your diet than if you go out and buy lunch when you're hungry. This lunch from home is a commitment device. Prepaid cards are a commitment device that are becoming more common at coffee shops and college campuses. Typically, one puts a dollar amount on that prepaid card and uses it for any item sold at the coffee shop or cafeteria. Retailers could go one step further by offering a healthy prepaid card for purchasing only certain healthful menu items. Other less healthful items could still be purchased, but not with that prepaid card.
So why would the USDA find this information useful?
Wow, Sheila, that's another great question. USDA's nutrition assistance programs like Food Stamp, WIC, and School Meals affect the lives of millions of people each day, and typically over half of all program participants are children. Now, a lot of what we think is good or acceptable to eat is determined when we are very young. So, finding ways to encourage program participants to make healthier food choices is such a great opportunity because these programs can help us guide food choices at a critical time when we are young and beginning to define what we do and don't like to eat. Thinking of how to use findings from behavioral economics within the nutrition assistant programs expands the list of possible ideas for improving diet quality. And it does so without restricting the right to choose the foods we like. But I just want to be clear. At this point, we are only talking about the possibility of considering new strategies within these programs. We are by no means recommending or endorsing any of these ideas. A thorough analysis of costs, benefits, and potential impacts would be needed before any strategy could be considered as a policy option. With that said, changing default options and using commitment devices are strategies that might also be applicable to the food stamp or school meal programs. For example, a default food stamp package could be more restrictive by specifying how much to spend on whole grain foods, vegetables, and fruits. However, recipients could still choose the current non-restrictive food stamp benefits. Within the school meal programs, a healthy meal or side could be the default offering. Also in the school meal program, students with their parents could specify that only more healthful items be purchased with prepaid cards. Or they could specify what portion of the total school lunch bill could be spent on fruits, vegetables, desserts, and sodas. Allowing students to pre-select menu options may improve the healthfulness of their food choices as well. Among food stamp participants, pre-ordering groceries either online or by phone for home delivery could help people make choices that are more in sync with their dietary goals. By pre-ordering food, they would be able to commit to buying more nutritious food by not being tempted in the store.
Lisa, you've given us a lot to chew on. Thanks for spending some time with us to share your findings.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Lisa Mancino, the author of Insidious Consumption, Surprising Factors That Influence What We Eat and How Much, appearing in the June issue of Amber Waves. You can find the complete article at ers.usda.gov/amberwaves. You will also find articles on the importance of government payments to farm households, how food safety practices are being reassessed by producers and government agencies, and what food insecurity statistics tell us about the hardships households face in meeting their food needs. This is Sheila Sankaran. Thank you for listening.
This has been a podcast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service.